resource. It's great to have Billy. I was introduced as coming from Yorkshire. He comes from the the wrong side of the Pennines nowadays. But anyway, we still get on. Let's give Billy a very warm welcome, shall we?
Thank you, Roger.
Billy, it's great to have you. It is sad, though, isn't it, that you live in
Lancashire.
Lancashire, oh dear.
Yeah.
Whereabouts?
A little place called Ormskirk, which is just north of Liverpool, quite close to Southport on the northwest coast.
And you described it earlier as a town that really would fit comfortably in England 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's how someone described it not so long ago. It was like stepping back in time to England of an older age.
Now, you clearly, from your accent, you weren't brought up in England. You were brought up in Northern Ireland. Whereabouts?
Yeah, I was brought up in East Belfast.
Somebody's heard of it.
Somebody heard it, yeah. Yeah, there you are. There's someone from the East. Lower Newtownards Road, very working class area. And grew up in the shadow of Harland and Wolff. Most folks that see any images of Belfast today, they would see those two iconic sort of cranes, big yellow cranes with an H and W on them. I remember those cranes being built in the 1960s. So fascinated as a young boy growing up watching these super tankers and bulk carriers being built just across the road from me.
So Belfast quite famous for building ships. In fact, I think you built the Titanic. I was going to say. Sorry,
well,
but anyway,
it was okay when it left Belfast.
All right. So Billy, tell us a bit about your home. What was it like?
Yeah, it was a happy home. There was my dad and my mum. My mum and dad, they married after he was demobbed after the Second World War. I had an older brother and an older sister and a younger sister. It was a very happy home. Didn't have much materially, but we had a lot of love and a lot of happiness within the home.
And you know, elsewhere in the UK, we wouldn't particularly ask this, but it was a Protestant home, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a Protestant home. Although the area was in the 1960s, it was a mixed area. There was Roman Catholics and Protestants living together in that part of East Belfast. Although the majority of the population would have been Protestant, there were still some Roman Catholic families.
And Billy, was your family a church-going family? Were you all involved in church?
No, I was sent to Sunday school as a little boy. My dad, he did not believe in God. He had been in Belsen 3 days after it was liberated, and he said the camp had been cleaned up considerably in the space of 3 days, but he said what he saw and convinced him that there couldn't be a God. So my dad didn't believe in God. My mum was probably a little bit more God-fearing rather than being a Christian, but she was the one that sent us out to Sunday school.
And you once told me that she loved to sing, so she went around the house.
Yeah.
And what sort of music did
well,
she sing?
Well, you know, my dad, he was out working. My mum stayed at home to bring up the children. And I can remember her going around the house singing as a little boy. She would sing lots of country songs, lots of Patsy Cline, etc. And I told Rod, this is where I got a lot of my love for country music, you know, from my mum, remembering her singing a lot of those songs as she cleaned. And my older brother, he was more into the Rolling Stones, etc., a bit of soul. So my love for, you know, Motown, etc., comes from him. My sister was into the Beatles, so a lot of an eclectic mix of music, you know, growing up pop music.
Now, life was to dramatically change when you were just 11 years of age, and because of the advertisements, obviously we're aware a little bit about it. But tell us what happened. Tell if you know, it's a sensitive issue, but try and recall what happened that day, please.
Well, for some of the younger folks here, you won't remember, but back in the late 60s into the early 70s, 80s and 90s, a lot of trouble broke out in the streets of of Northern Ireland, and particularly Belfast, etc. And there was as much coverage about Northern Ireland on the news as there is about maybe Afghanistan, etc. today. At the beginning of the Troubles, Saturday the 27th of June 1970, if I had time this evening, I could practically take you through each step of that day. It was a beautiful, beautiful summer's day. And I got up that morning and went to the local park with my dad, spent the better part of that day with my dad. It holds precious memories. And yet that night, Saturday the 27th of June 1970, my father was shot dead by the IRA. He wasn't the first civilian to be shot dead. He was among one of the first civilians to be shot dead. I can remember hearing a burst of automatic gunfire around about 11:30. It was about 400 yards from us, or sorry, 400 meters. Little did I know that it was my dad, you know, being shot dead. When that sort of burst of automatic gunfire happened, from that moment on, for the next several hours, there was just constant gunfire. It didn't stop. And because the gunfire had started, I was pulled into a neighbor's house. And I was sitting in the seat with my eyes closed. I wasn't sleeping. And people were coming in, and I could hear hushed whispers. Does he know? Has anybody told him? It's awful. It's terrible. Things like this.
Mm. Now, that weekend, actually, seven people were murdered, weren't they? Mm-hmm. Why your father?
Well, he was just coming home from a social club. And it used to be the custom or the habit that when, you know, they had finished, my dad was a social drinker. He even out, you know, had a drink with his friends. And each week they would go to someone else's house, and the wife would make, you know, soup or put on, so we would say in Northern Ireland, put the pan on, and it would be a full Ulster fry. And my dad, they were coming back to our house that night. My dad said to his friends, I'll run on ahead and tell Kathleen, that's my mum, tell Kathleen to put on the teapot and, you know, get something, some food organized. And as he turned the corner to come down home, it was just an indiscriminate shooting. The people who shot him knew that anybody they killed on the other side of the road would have been the enemy, as they perceived it. So it was just an indiscriminate
killing. So
your
father wasn't involved politically or militarily in the Troubles?
No.
It was just, and how were you told, Billy, about your father?
Well, as I was saying, I was in this neighbour's house. There was the gunfire, so it was impossible to sleep. I heard the whispers, the hush whispers, and I remember standing up in the house and saying, what don't I know? What haven't you told me? What's awful? And I started to run towards the door of the house, and people's hands were trying to grab me to pull me back in. And I wrestled free, and I got out onto the street, and I started to run up the street, which would have brought me in line with the gunfire. I can remember seeing the little white lights of the tracer bullets at the top of the street. And I was running up the street, and my friend's dad grabbed me. And but this time I was crying, and I was saying, where's my daddy, where's my daddy? And he said to me, Billy, your daddy's not coming home. Your daddy's dead. And I can remember saying to him, perhaps it's God's will. And he grabbed me by the shoulders, and he nearly shook the life out of me. And he said, this is nothing to do with God. There is no God. And he used an expletive and said, it's those bees across the road, referring to the Republican community. And he said, never you forget that. And I guess from that moment on, I didn't forget it, you know, that maybe there wasn't a God. And really, I did write God out of my life from that moment. I never went back to Sunday school. If there had been a God, he could have stopped my dad being gunned down in the street. there was a God who's all powerful, as I'm told. Well, he certainly lacked the power that night.
Did anybody from the church come and visit you?
Not as far as I know. Now, there may have been, but as a young lad at 12. And
did you as an 11-year-old go to the funeral itself?
Yeah. Funerals in Northern Ireland are not like funerals in England in the sense that, you know, if someone dies, maybe it could be 2 weeks later before the funeral. In Northern Ireland, it's within 3 days. And so my dad was buried on the 30th of June. That was my brother's 18th birthday. And so he said, you know, I was talking to him, you know, a while ago, and he said, you know, my 18th birthday, my memory of it is carrying my dad on my shoulders in his coffin. And I walked behind my dad's coffin at the age of 12. Today, when there are funerals or there's a 2-minute silence, I don't know whether it's people find it hard to handle grief or they find it hard to handle 2-minute silence, but you have this weird 2 minutes applause or people applauding the cortege as it goes past. I remember when my dad, it's indelibly marked in my mind, as the coffin was coming down the street, and because my dad, I think, was one of the first civilians who was killed, it was thronged with people, you know, thousands of people, and somebody started to sing Psalm 23, "The Lord's My Shepherd," and somebody else picked it up, and an abiding memory of that day is walking behind my dad's funeral with, you know, these thousands of people singing, "The Lord's My Shepherd."
Your mum stopped singing, didn't she? Mm-hmm. Never sang again. Well,
I can't begin to explain the hatred and the bitterness that entered the home life after my dad was killed. My mother was 3 months pregnant at the time. And 6 months later to the day, my kid brother was born. And the singing stopped. And the home was filled literally with hate and bitterness. I can still remember my little brother running in off the street and running up to my mum and asking what a daddy was. How come his friends had a daddy to talk about and he hadn't? And to see my mum break down in tears trying to explain why there was no father figure in the home sows seeds of hatred and bitterness to a greater degree and to a greater extent. Now I know that, you know, my family don't have a monopoly on violence. Lots and lots of families have been touched as a result of the madness of terrorism, not only in Northern Ireland, but also Southern Ireland and here in mainland Britain. And people react differently when it comes to their doorstep. Certainly within my family, there was an increasing hatred every day.
And were you bound up in this? Were you feeling vengeful and bitter?
Feeling vengeful and bitter from the moment my mate's dad shook me that night and said, "There is no God, and make sure you get your own back."
And then, Billy, eventually you had the opportunity of joining the UVF.
That's right.
Now, what is the UVF?
Just a terrorist organization. And sadly, today we do live in a world where we're all too familiar with terrorist and terrorist groups, you know. So.
And how old were you when you joined?
I was 16.
Did you have a uniform?
Well, we wore a black uniform.
And as a 16-year-old, did you swear an oath, a sort of oath of allegiance and loyalty to them?
You swear an oath of allegiance to the organization, and you're told as soon as you go into the organization, there's only one way out, and that's in a box. You don't walk away from the organization.
And Billy, did you understand what you were doing, do you think, as a 16-year-old joining the UVF?
As much as a 16-year-old could understand. You know, nobody twisted my arm up my back. You know, I volunteered my services. I wanted to get revenge. And I felt that the paramilitaries, the terrorist group, gave me more of an opportunity to get revenge than maybe joining the police or the army would.
And was your mother aware you were joining the UVF?
My mother was aware that I was involved in something, but they didn't know to what extent I was involved.
And as a 16-year-old, were you taught to handle a gun?
Well, the only thing you need to know about handling a gun is how to point it in the right direction and pull the trigger. And that was about as much as the training I got within the organization. I joined the Army Cadets as a young boy, so that's where I got most of my arms training. The organization would have trained me more in bomb making, because I felt I could kill more people with a bomb than I could with a gun. So I was training in explosives.
But Billy, so you're saying as a teenager, mm-hmm. you were intent on killing as many as you could?
That's right.
Of the enemy?
That's right.
Did you ever feel, what am I doing? I'm following a path that is really disastrous.
I never ever stopped to think. I would say that 16, 17-year-old who was involved in an organization was not thinking rationally. And so I never ever thought that I was creating a cycle of violence by my actions. Never thought that my actions were going to bring as much hurt and pain. Well, actually, I did want to bring as much hurt and pain upon
the
opposing community as it could, but I never thought about the consequences of those actions.
And Billy, you were told what to do. If there was a robbery, you'd be told to go and do that, would you?
Well, this is bizarre, you know, and I think we all have our warped morality. When I went into the organization, I was asked what was I willing to do, and I said I was only willing to kill people. And I remember the commander of the organization taking me round to a house where there was arms kept. And he said, you can come here anytime, get any of these arms. If you want to rob a post office, if you're short of money, if you want to rob a shop, if you're short of money, here's where you can get the guns. And I said, I didn't join this organization to rob. You know, I joined the organization to kill people. Now, that might sound warped to yourself, but that's
what I was thinking. It was just because you wanted revenge for your father's death.
And so robbing wasn't part of my thinking for the organization.
Now, Billy, at the age of 17, you did kill somebody, didn't you? Mm-hmm. Is it vivid in your memory?
It's like it's like something that's played over on a loop system. You know, I can still see it in my mind, printed indelibly in my mind.
And did you know anything about the person you killed?
The only thing I found out about him was afterwards when I went into prison. Initially, I thought he was a member of the IRA. Just before the shooting took place, I found out that he was a member of my own organization. He was a fellow UVF man. I was told that he was an informer. And I felt, well, an informer can do as much damage to the organization as a member of the IRA. So that, as far as I was concerned, was justification enough for taking the man's life. And that happened on the 19th of February, 1976.
And you know, did you look him in the eye or anything? Or?
I can still see his face. So I can, yeah. There were actually two of us carried out the shooting.
And when you ran away, how did you feel?
There was no sense of shame. There was no regret. There was no twinge of conscience. My conscience was dead. I felt that I had now proved myself to the organization. And having killed one, I can now go on a killing spree. That's how I felt at the age of 17.
So until the time when you were caught, Billy, were you sort of hiding from the police? Were you, I don't know, very insecure or what?
No, it was as arrogant and as brass and as brazen as any. You know, 17-year-old who now thought that he controlled life and death.
And how long afterwards were you eventually caught, arrested, whatever?
It was 2 weeks later.
Just a fortnight. And how do you think they knew?
Well, it came out in the court case. We were arrested, and the terminology that was used was arrested on information received. So it was somebody informed on us.
So they came to your house, arrested you?
Yeah, 6 in the morning, yeah.
And eventually you were tried. How long were you on remand?
14 months.
And what was that like?
Well, going into the Mays prison was interesting because the type of activity I was involved in, I was either going to end up in prison for a very long time or end up dead. So going into the Mays prison wasn't such a big shock to my system. There wasn't any sense of shame. There was a degree of pride that I had been arrested for doing something, as I thought, for my country. The Mays prison was opened solely to hold members of terrorist organizations, and I was put in a part of the prison during my remand time that solely held members of the Ulster Volunteer Force, and it was run along military lines. The prison authorities kept themselves to the edge of the compound. They didn't really interfere with how we run the place. So we were able to have bomb-making classes, etc., etc. In prison, yeah. And so, yes, it was. So that is one of the reasons why the prison authorities wanted to get rid of the compound system. Some of you who are older will remember the H blocks with the blanket protest, dirty protest, and hunger strike, because they were trying to get that compound system back again, where the paramilitaries basically run the prison. And so, you know, the very first order given to myself in prison was that I would encounter members of the Republican movement. I had not to say anything to them that would agitate them or cause them to react violently to me. And I was assured that they would not say anything to me that would cause me to react violently to them. That's what shocked me about going into the Mays prison. The fact that these guys had thrashed out an agreement and that there was stability in the prison. The conflict was outside. In fact, probably the safest place in Northern Ireland in the 1970s was the Mays prison. So it was.
Amazing. So now, Billy, we're going to hear how you became a Christian, but it's to us a million miles away from most of our lives. Mm-hmm. But for how long were you in prison? You were found guilty.
Yeah.
And what was your sentence?
I was sentenced to...
Did you plead guilty, by the way?
No, refused to recognise the court.
Okay.
Right, so...
Even though you were a unionist, a loyalist, yeah. Why did you refuse to recognise the court?
I can't remember.
Okay. But it sounded good at the time.
Yes, it sounded like a good idea at the time. The two of us refused to recognise the court. I was sentenced to be detained under the Secretary of State's pleasure, which is basically a life sentence.
But that's because you were under 18.
Because I was under the age of 17, yeah. And it was arrogant. I practically laughed in the judge's face. No sense of shame or regret or remorse.
And that was genuine. It wasn't just bravado. You really felt no shame.
No shame.
And for how long were you in prison?
Just under 10 years, which was a relatively short space of time for the seriousness of the crime.
Now, until you became a Christian, we'll find out this amazing transformation that happened. Again, was there any sense of, what is life all about? Did you ever go to the chapel services? Do you ever think of crying out to God when Christmas came? Did you ever think what this is all about? Or?
There was no, well, obviously I had ample time in my hands. You know, these guys had come to an agreement in prison. You know, these loyalists and Republicans, they had thrashed out an agreement. And, you know, if these guys could come to an agreement in prison, there has to be an agreement out of prison. We can't carry on killing each other and blowing each other up. There has to be an answer. So what's the answer? Well, it certainly, as far as I was concerned, wasn't God. It wasn't religion. You know, part of Ireland's problems was religion. So the last thing Ireland needed was more God. What was needed... It was a political situation. It therefore demanded a political answer. And with ample time on my hands, looking for answers, I went into a study of politics. For long enough, studied Marxism, studied guerrilla warfare, got books
in the prison library?
No, books that were sent in to me in prison that I read that taught me how to conduct a guerrilla warfare when I come out of prison. You know, what targets... How to conduct it psychologically, economically, culturally, everything. And I studied this avidly because I wanted to come out of prison a better educated terrorist.
Amazing. And that continued for 7 years. Did your mum make much contact with you?
Mum visited me every week.
Did it break her heart to see you there?
Yeah.
Did she feel at all responsible that she'd sort of bred the spiteful, vengeful attitude?
No, I think she would have blamed it all on the IRA. The only reason you're here is because your dad was murdered. The only reason you're here because of what the IRA had done to the family. Mm. I remember her coming up to the prison. My friend that I did things with in the organization, he was blown to bits on the streets of Belfast just under a year after I had gone into prison. We were supposed to carry out the shooting together. And what happened, they only needed one of us to do the shooting because there was somebody else from another unit going to accompany us. And we were arguing about who was going to carry out the shooting. And the commander of the organization pulled a coin out of his pocket and he tossed the coin in the air. Hmm. And I called heads. So I got to do the shooting and ended up in prison. My friend was blown to bits in Belfast. And I remember my mum coming up to see me the first visit after I'd heard about my friend. And she said, I can go to bed at night and sleep. Because when you were out, she said, I often dreaded you coming home to me the way your friend has been brought home to his mum. So she said, I can sleep at night with you in here.
Amazing. So, Billy, we've heard this dark, dark story. Tell us now, what happened then that was to so transform you?
Yeah. One of the first Christians that I encountered in prison was a fellow who I had been on remand with, a fellow called Peter Thompson. Peter was arrested about 3 weeks after me. He was sentenced about 3 weeks after me. And after I was sentenced, because of a technicality in the way the police phrased the charges, I ended up in the H blocks. Okay, so I moved from the compound system where the paramilitaries had complete control into this H block. And it was the same with Peter Thompson after he was arrested. The police phrased the charge in such a way that after he was sentenced, he was also going to be moved to the H block. So Peter arrives in the H block. And he's carrying a Bible. And I thought, you know, this is quite bizarre, like, because I knew Peter. And, you know, what had happened to Peter? Because all of a sudden he's talking about Jesus. Well, you know, Peter's just been given a life sentence. And Peter wants to get out of prison early. Hmm. And what's the best way to get out of prison early? But, you know, instead of carrying a bomb, you know, carry a Bible. And tell the authorities that you're now a good person because you're got a bit of religion in your life. But as far as I was concerned, you know, Peter was a hypocrite. He was a phony. He couldn't pull the wool over my eyes. He couldn't face up to the pressures of the penal system. He needed a crutch to lean on. Christianity was his crutch. Now, Peter nominated himself the block barber. Okay, so if you needed a haircut, you had to send for Peter. Like, Peter had never cut anybody's hair in his life, right?
Sounds like my barber.
Okay. But, you know, Peter nominating himself the block barber meant that he had full run, if you like, of the H block. Anybody needed a haircut had to send for Peter. So he got into all the wings. And as soon as he got you in the chair, you know, cutting your hair, I remember this. He would be standing cutting your hair, talking about Jesus, and you'd be saying, like, Peter, give over. I don't want to know about this Jesus. And he would get the scissors, and he would put them into the side of your neck, and he would start to press quite hard. And he would say, right, he says, just a little more pressure, and I'm into your jugular. And you're lying here in the pool of blood. And he says, see, before they get a medical officer down this wing to stem this flow, you'll be dead. And if you're not trusting in the Lord Jesus Christ, you'll be in hell. And
this is not a technique we're commending.
No, but this is how he used to do it. And if Peter made a mess of your hair, you couldn't do anything because he was a big guy, like. And so Peter was the first Christian that I really encountered with this really terrible way of evangelizing. And he Around this time also, I started to receive these magazines from New Zealand. Now, this is weird, but this is how it happened. A long brown envelope through the top of the cell door, and it's great to get a letter in prison. I get off my bed and pick this letter up, and don't recognize the writing. The postmark's New Zealand. Pull out the contents of this envelope, and it's a magazine. Catch the name of Jesus somewhere in the corner, and I put it back inside the envelope, curl it up in a ball, and threw it in the waste paper bin. I had no time for God, no time for religion. 6 or 8 weeks later, another one of these long brown envelopes. Now, this happened around about 1978. These things started to come. I recognized the postmark. I recognized the stamp, both New Zealand. It was a handwritten address on the envelope. The only mistake was my prison number was 691. These folks had written G91. Everything else was correct. I know what's inside it. It's a religious magazine. It's going into the bin. Peter Thompson's still running about talking about Jesus, so I think, you know, these magazines are coming from the other side of the world to go into my waste paper bin. Peter's into religion. I'll send these magazines to Peter. And that's exactly what I did. As soon as they reached me, I would give them back out to the prison officer and say, send them to Peter Thompson. I run into Peter one night. It was at August. I'll bring you up to August 1980. Terrible, terrible migraine headache. And I went out to the medical room for headache tablets. Who's in the medical room but Peter Thompson? And I said to Peter, I hope you're getting the magazines. I don't know who's sending them, but you're quite welcome to them, Peter. And the medical officer looked up, and he would not get away with us today, you know, but the medical officer looked up and he said, do you not think it's God who's sending you these magazines? And I'd never heard anything as stupid in my life. God sending magazines from New Zealand to the Mays prison. And when you have a splitting migraine headache, you know, that's the last thing you want to hear. And I remember saying to this medical officer, look, I am skeptical about God. I do not believe that God exists. And usually when I said to a Christian, whether it was a prison officer or a prisoner like Peter, I don't believe in God, they would always say, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God, quoting from what I now know is one of the Psalms, Psalm 14, verse 1, or 53, verse 1. So I was waiting in this medical officer saying, you're a fool. I was going to throw him a line of argument, take my headache tablets, get offside. And he looked at me and he said, oh, you're skeptical about God. And I said, that's right. You don't believe God exists. And I said, that's right. He's going to call me a fool because you can read these Christians like a book. And he looked at me and he said, well, I want to tell you something, kid. Regardless of whether you believe in God or not, it doesn't take away the fact that there is a God. Nor does it take away the fact that if you die in the state that you're in at the moment, you're going to go straight to hell. And once you get there, kid, you will not be skeptical anymore. In fact, you will be a believer. Because everybody in that place believes. And the tragedy of it is this, that once you're there, there's no release date. There's no way out. And I couldn't hit him with a line of argument for if the fool has said in his heart. He had wrong foot at me. And I turned and I hightailed it out of that medical room. If there's a heaven and a hell, no argument. I know where I'm going. But is there a heaven and a hell? Is there a God? You know what? Religion's right. You have Jews, you have Buddhists, you have Muslims, you have Sikhs, etc., etc., etc. You know, here I am in this prison encountering these Christian prisoners and Christian prison officers. And what's really, really annoying about them is their arrogance and their dogmatism. You know, that their way is the only way. Their Bible is the only Bible. Nobody else gets a look in. You know, such crass arrogance, like. But a seed had been sown in my mind. And I started to ask lots of questions. Becoming very disenchanted by communism at this stage, it didn't answer anything. Communism just channeled my hate in another direction. And what I can't give an adequate explanation for, and as I said, this is weird, it's freaky, it just happened like this. Those magazines that had been coming on a regular basis every 6 or 8 weeks for about 2 years, I never received another one after that encounter in the medical room. That is just how it happened. Christmas Eve 1980, a woman called Gladys Blackburn came down to my cell. Gladys came into the prison as part of the Board of Visitors, people drawn from civilian society that could come into the prison, make sure that it's run along humane lines. And Gladys...
I'll come in here, because I knew Gladys Blackburn. She was head of maths in a grammar school in Belfast. She was just so embarrassed about the troubles and her country leading to the British troops coming over here. She met all the soldiers when they went to Northern Ireland, and she also started visiting. And the British Army would fly her by helicopter anywhere she wanted to go. She was a remarkable old lady, wasn't she?
Yeah, Gladys was remarkable. If there are any folks here that served in Northern Ireland in the forces, when your flight landed in RAF Aldergrove, a lot of times she would have been standing at the bottom of the steps and just giving the troops out some gospel tracts. If a soldier was injured or blown up, she would always visit him in Musgrave Park Military Hospital. She also came up to the prison. A remarkable woman. And yes, the army did put on helicopters for her to run her around the border bases.
Anyway, sorry, she visited you on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, she visited me on Christmas Eve. After a bit of formal conversation, she lifted down the Bible. She turned to Luke chapter 23, and she began to read the story of the crucifixion. And a superscription also was written over him in letters of Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. This is the King of the Jews. And one of the malefactors, or one of the thieves, which was hanged, railed in him, saying, "If you are the Christ, save yourself and us." But the other answering rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, seeing we are in the same condemnation, and we indeed justly? For we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing amiss." And he said unto Jesus, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And she stopped at that 42nd verse. She said, "Think for a moment who this thief is calling Lord. Here's a man with a crown of thorns pushed into his head. A man whose back has been lacerated with a Roman whip. They've spat upon him, they've punched him, they've beaten him. They've stripped him naked to humiliate him. Here he is hanging in this middle cross. And this thief addresses him with a defined title, calls him Lord, calls him God." And she said to me, "Does he look like God to you?" Because on the cross, Jesus Christ was still God. He was still Lord over all, blessed forever. I can remember her, vaguely remember her saying that. Vaguely remember her saying that because as she was describing what Jesus must have looked like on the cross, at that moment I can wonder what I can now term as a conviction of sin. Couldn't put it in that terminology back then. It was just as if every wrong that I had ever committed in my life, I felt the overwhelming weight of that wrong. For the very first time in my life, I felt guilty. For the very first time in my life, I felt the enormity of the consequences of my guilt. For the first time, I realized that, yes, if I died in the state that I was in, I was justly going to hell. For the first time in my life, I realized also that Jesus Christ was dying on the cross for me, and it was as personal as that. That he was dying for me, he was taking a rap for me, that God didn't turn a blind eye to my actions. My actions had to be punished. Where were those actions punished? They were punished on Jesus. He was dying for me. He was taking my place. And I turned and I asked that woman, "How do you become a Christian?" And she explained it as simply as ABC. Accept Jesus Christ died for you, believe it, and then you go out and confess it to others. And accept it and believe it. Yeah, confess it to others. That's a sticking point. To tell people I was a Christian. I didn't want people to think of me the way I thought of Peter Thompson. Now, that's pride, isn't it? That you couldn't do your time, that you're needing a crutch to lean on. You're trying to work your ticket. You're trying to get out early, blah, blah, blah.
But when she went, you did trust Jesus, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, that night, I realized that if Jesus Christ loved me enough to die for me, surely I love him enough to go out and confess him to others. And that night, Christmas Eve 1980, I got down on my knees in a cell, 8 block 7 of the Mays prison, and repented of my sin. and I threw a waste of life before God. Now, there was no claps of thunder. There was no funny mystical experience. There was no flashes of lightning or anything like that. It was a simple prayer of faith. And God heard that prayer because my life was radically changed.
I just want to pick, time's gone, but I just want to pick you up on one or two things. You said you repented of your sin. Was this the first time you felt the regrets about how you'd lived and what you'd done?
That was the very first time. Before that, if you had met me in a maze prison and said, are you guilty? Do you deserve to be here? I would have, in a warped way, I would have tried to justify my actions. But after I came face to face with the cross of Christ, there was no justification. I was guilty and I deserved to be where I was. So that was the first time I really felt any degree of guilt or remorse or regret.
So you asked Jesus to forgive you. Now, God promises that if we ask, you'll be forgiven. But how did that outwork itself? What difference did that make to you then and there, Billy?
Yeah, well for the first, I felt clean. You know, it's amazing just how clean I felt after that. There was also a peace which passes understanding that the Bible talks about. You know, before I was a Christian, I was very restless, angry, full of bitter, full of hate, full of bitterness, full of hate, never content. But after I became a Christian, the hatred went, the bitterness went, the anger went.
Well, all instantly?
All instantly. It all went. And it was just like I was a new creature. It wasn't that God gave me a crutch to lean on. I found that he gave me a new life, a brand new life. And there was an acknowledgement that I deserved to be where I was. You know, if I was still in the maze prison today, justice would still be being done. But also just my attitude to my enemies. You know, there was now a love for them where there was once a hate. And I had a spiritual dimension in my life. And now I find myself praying. I didn't really pray before. Reading the Bible, I didn't want to read the Bible. But now I find myself reading the Bible. I want to go to church. Before I'm a Christian, I don't want to go to church. Now there's a spiritual dimension to my life.
How much longer did you serve? 3 more years?
Another 5.
5 years, sorry. And was that tough?
It was tough as a Christian inside, yeah. It's tough as a Christian outside, obviously. But when you're living in close confinement with people 7 days a week, 365 days a year, you can't escape them. So if you're saying you're a Christian, they watch every move you make. And if you're trying to talk to them about your faith, if you're not living in a consistent manner, they won't listen. So in many respects, it was a good training ground.
Your mum, how did she react?
Well, my family reacted differently. Obviously, I write out to family and friends and tell them what had happened. My sister said anything's better than communism. So, you know, Christianity is just his next little phase. My mum got a letter from my mum. It was sent for by the senior prison officer. It was Saturday morning. I go out to his office. He has a letter in front of him. He was a Christian man, a guy called McGee. I can't remember his first name. But he said, "We have a letter here from your mum. We have censored it. Every letter going into prison is censored." He said, "We're not sure whether we should give you this letter or not because we're not sure how you're going to react when you read the contents of it." So I asked him for the letter. And he picked it up and he said, "The only thing that's going to help your mother is prayer." And I took the letter and went down to the cell. It was Saturday morning. Some of you remember Swap Shop, don't you? Swap Shop was on, so everybody was in watching Swap Shop. Which meant that I had the cell to myself. And I was glad because by the time I had got to the end of the letter, I was crying, sitting on the end of the bed, crying my eyes out like a child. My mum was saying to me, "How could I talk to her about a God of love? Where was this great God of love the night your dad was gunned down in the street like a dog by the IRA scum?" And I can still see it underlined. And she shared in the letter about how she met my dad after he came out of the forces in the Second World War, all their plans, their hopes, their dreams for the future, and how it was all ruined. And, you know, where was God? This great God of love you're talking about. I must have been reading Romans at the time. And I sat down that night and wrote her a letter based on Romans 12:19. Vengeance is mine, says God, I will repay. I tried to explain to her that part of my problem and our family's problem was that we thought vengeance belonged to us. Vengeance belongs to God. I sent a covering letter to my younger sister, who by this time was professing to be a Christian. And I said to her, look, get down and get my mum and take her to church with you. Now, a couple of weeks after that, letters come back and forth on a regular basis, but this one was significant. About two weeks later, a letter from my mother. This is how she started it. I now know what you mean about God's forgiveness. Tonight at church, I became a Christian. And when I saw my mum saved, I saw a mountain of hatred and bitterness that had accumulated over 10 years. God in his love and his mercy put his hand down, and he lifted that mountain and he cast it into the depths of the sea. And what did God do for my mum? Well, she started singing again. And God puts the song back into the broken life. I was just saying to Roger, I was speaking to her today on the phone. She's 86 now. But she still loves the Lord, you know, and she has that peace.
Time has gone, yeah. But quickly, why should you be forgiven? You're a pastor of a church now, and yet your past is dreadful, really. Mm-hmm. Why should you be forgiven?
Well, forgiveness is open to everybody. God says that whoever comes on to him, in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, he will never turn them away. That offer of forgiveness is open to everybody. Mm. And why God should have been merciful to me and not the person in the cell next door to me, I don't know. You know, that's something that's, you know, hidden with God. You know, why he reached down and touched my heart and my life, that's God's grace. You know, undeserved favor. I didn't deserve it. But God changed my life the 24th of December, 1980. He turned it around. You know, God saves people in his time for his glory. I would rather have, you know, been saved as a young boy rather than going through all that I've come through. And, you know, I know there's some young folk here tonight, and if I could just say to those young folk, you know, what you've heard tonight is a story of a conversion that's quite unusual. You might be a young Christian and think, oh, I don't have a story like that. But the story of God's saving grace is miraculous wherever it takes place. Mm-hmm. And you know, with me, my it was a Damascus Road experience for me, you know, going from black to white. It's not like that for everybody. My wife became a Christian when she was 8 years old. She went to university, maintained her walk during those university years, didn't cause her mother and mum much grief. Hmm. I would love to have a testimony like that.
I'd love to have a daughter like that. But yeah. Anyway,
Billy, sorry, it's great. Roger, I'd love I've to
ask.
On, hey.
No, I'd love to ask more questions. Time's gone. We're going to have a shorter sort of service tomorrow lunchtime. We'll find out a bit more. Yeah. You've got children, and your youngest one, I think, still isn't absolutely certain about you.
No,
and your history.
That's right, Jonah. He's 11. He keeps asking questions. I haven't got to the point yet where I find that I can ask him questions. So he's probing a bit, and he says, why did they put you in prison? Did they put you in prison for speeding? And I said, well, it's a bit more serious.
We'll have to leave it there, but Billy will be around. Please do talk to him. I've let the interview run a little. I'll be briefer in the second section. Mm-hmm. Shall we show our appreciation? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you very much. But I'm always deeply moved. I've interviewed Billy a few times, but when his mum sings again, isn't that a touching moment? Thank you very much.